Good evening, brothers and sisters, friends, guests. I'd like to extend the same welcome from our presiding brother to this very interesting subject, and not only very interesting, more than just very interesting. We believe that anyone, irreligious or religious, would look at the history of the Jews and admit that it's a very interesting history. More than that, the history of the Jews and the future of the Jews is at the heart of the purpose of God. And we believe that we shall be able to the best of our ability at least, establish from the scriptures that the Jews are really at the center of his plan and purpose. We read in Numbers 24 something which was said by someone who was actually a foe of the Jews. This is what he said, looking down upon the assembly of the Jews recently departed from Egypt. This is what he said, "How goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy tabernacles, O Israel, as the valleys are they spread forth, as gardens by the river's side, as the trees of line aloes, which the Lord hath planted, and as cedar trees beside the waters." He couched, he lay down as a lion, and as a great lion, who shall stir him up? Blessed is he that blesseth thee, and cursed is he that curseth thee. For from the top of the rocks I see him, and from the hills I behold him. Lo, the people shall dwell alone, and shall not be reckoned among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob, and the number of the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my last end be like his. Those words were spoken overlooking, as we said, that encampment of Israel. And the onlooker, Balaam, the son of Bozor, could see arrayed before him in the wilderness. The scene before him would have been a lot drier and arid than that picture you see there up on the slide. In the wilderness, there before him were the people of Israel, divided into four encampments of three tribes. And at the very center, enshrined in the midst of this people of Israel, there was the tabernacle. And overshadowing that was a cloud by day and a fire by night. This was no ordinary congregation. There was order, structure, purpose, and worship. This wasn't the ordinary nomadic Amalekite-style tribe who were wandering, pillaging, and just terrorizing any nations around. This was a nation to be reckoned with, to be feared. And indeed, fear was instilled into the king of Moab, Balak. And so he hired this man Balaam, whose words we have just read, to curse God's people. And instead of a curse, came forth a blessing. It's remarkable and somewhat prophetic of the ongoing plight of the Jews that before they'd even inhabited their land, before they were even 40 years old as an independent nation, already someone was seeking their hurt, someone was already seeking their destruction. And it wasn't even the first time, because of course Egypt had tried to do the same. Pharaoh had tried to exterminate this people before they'd even become an independent nation as they were. This, as we shall see, was no ordinary people. So the attempt to persecute these people began at their very beginning, and it has continued ever since. We read in Isaiah 43, "Ye are my witnesses, saith the Lord, that I am God." So the existence of the Jews And the plight of the Jews, which we are thinking about this evening, is a witness that the Lord is God. It is a proof, it's a testimony, a witness that the Lord is God. You only have I known of all the families of the earth, we read in Amos. And the verse continues, therefore, that they would be persecuted for their iniquities or suffer for their iniquities. For thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are on the face of the earth. What these verses show us is that Israel were a special people. They were a holy people, a separate people. They were separated from other nations for God's specific purpose. Because of that special relationship, because of that special selection and separation of those people, they had great commensurate responsibilities. Israel faced a choice between supreme blessing or supreme cursing. They were either to be the most blessed, the most privileged, the most admired people, the most successful of all, or they were to be a scorn, a derision, persecuted, despised, scattered amongst all nations and should find no rest for the sole of their feet. Their obedience to God, or otherwise, was to determine their fate. In the introductory reading, we didn't read verse 1, but it says in that 28th chapter of Deuteronomy, shall come to pass, if thou shalt diligently hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe and to do all his commandments which I command thee this day, that the Lord thy God will set thee on high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come on thee and overtake thee, if thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God. And there are ensuing blessings enumerated up until verse 14. And then in verse 15, to the end of the chapter which we read, which is a chapter of 68 verses, a pretty long chapter, from verse 15 on, we read, it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. And it continues. So even in disobedience, even when Israel are disobeying the commandments of God and are scattered and derided and persecuted, they are still witnesses that the Lord is God, that Yahweh is God. So the purpose of this address is not just to give us an interesting history of Israel, although it definitely is that. It's not just an interesting history. We hope to show that Israel are an integral part of God's purpose. Jesus said at the well of Samaria, he was speaking to a Samaritan woman there who had come to him. And in the discussion with her, he said, salvation is of the Jews. Salvation is related to and appertaining to the things concerning the people of Israel. Paul, on a different occasion, when he was arraigned before Agrippa, he probably had chains about him. He was there before a court, essentially, being quizzed as to the recent accusations made against him by the Jews. He said to King Agrippa, now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto the fathers, and to which promise our 12 tribes, instantly serving God day and night, hope to come. For which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews. He said that's why he was there. He was there because of the promise made of God to the fathers. For which hope's sake, he said, he was accused of the Jews. Those very people who had assembled to accuse him, he shared the same hope with them, he said. the second aspect of this address, which will be sort of intertwined with the first, is to show that Israel is a miracle, and it's a proof of God's existence, as well as a witness that He is God. Israel's dispersion, as we've already read from Deuteronomy 28, was a fulfillment of prophecy. Deuteronomy 28 said that if they were disobedient, which we know they were, then they would be scattered amongst all nations and would suffer there. And they would find no rest for the soles of their feet, and they would go from nation to nation. We've seen that happen. So their dispersion was a fulfillment of prophecy. The spread of the Jews in an unusual way throughout all of the earth's surface, essentially, again, is a fulfillment of prophecy. Their survival in dispersion is even more amazing. And their return. Their return despite being hated of all men. And their continued survival, surrounded by enemies to this day, who are sworn to their extermination and make no pretense about the fact that their object is the annihilation of the Jew. All of these things were a fulfillment of prophecy. And pretty much all those things were improbabilities. We might even go as far as to say impossibilities without the hand of God. It was only with the hand of God that all those things could be fulfilled exactly as they were, and as they are being fulfilled before our very eyes. We have an interesting quotation here from someone who's probably fairly well known down south, probably throughout the whole of USA. It's Mark Twain, and he wrote this in, I've forgotten what it was called, it was an essay on the Jews, I believe. And he said this: if the statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race. It suggests a nebulous dim puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of. Has always been heard of. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, and the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now, or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? I guess Mark Twain was putting that question there at the end in a sort of a rhetorical way, and maybe he knew the answer. Certainly, we for sure know the answer. And we know exactly the answer because God has clearly given it to us in Scripture. And in Jeremiah chapter 30, we read in verse 10 and 11, "Therefore fear thou not, O my servant Jacob, saith the Lord, neither be dismayed, O Israel, for lo, I will save thee from afar, and thy seed from the land of their captivity, and Jacob shall return, and shall be in rest, and be quiet, and none shall make him afraid. For I am with thee, saith the Lord, to save thee." That is the secret of their success. That's the secret of the immortality of the Jew. "Though I make a full end of all nations, whither I have scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee. But I will correct thee in measure, and will not leave thee altogether unpunished." So Mark Twain observed that many of those kingdoms in their splendor had arisen, but in turn had passed away. Likewise, the remaining nations which might take up the drama of the present, they too shall pass away. All nations will be made an end of. But God says, I will not make a full end of thee. So in good times and bad, God's hand is ever present. And right even before the Israelites were brought into existence as a people, there was a promise that they should be under divine protection. Because when Abraham was called out of Ur, God said to him, I will bless him that blesseth thee and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all nations be blessed. And incidentally, as a side note, the importance of the land itself, which the Jews occupy today, was settled at that time. The whole question of whose is the land of Israel has already been settled and decided. All we wait for is for God to fulfill the other parts of his promise to ensure that that land of Israel is cleared of the profane, unbelieving, and the haters of his people. As I'm sure everyone would sympathise, I have a lot that I could be talking about here, and quite a long period to cover. We're not going to be dwelling too much on the history in the Bible times, but we've got a timeline there, which gives us some sense of perspective in the sense of the history of the plight of the Jews. I must apologise to those who are better at chronology than myself and who might, after this address, come and correct me on some of these dates. But as I say, this is more than anything to give us some sense of the scales involved here. And we can see that it really begins with Abraham, who leaves Haran in the year BC 2066. The Exodus takes place in 1626. Solomon builds the temple in 1022. Now, the building of the temple by Solomon is significant because this was really the high watermark of Israel's history. If we look at the past, this was when Israel's kingdom was at its height. This was the zenith of Israel's kingdom. And that prayer of Solomon, where he ascribed glory to God at the inauguration of the temple, Solomon the son of David, with a kingdom which was at its largest expanse, was really the pinnacle in those days of God's kingdom on earth. It also began 430 years that Ezekiel emblemizes by lying on his right and left side for 430 days, 390 years on his left side and 40 years on his right. It was emblemizing a period of 430 years of disobedience on the part of the Jews. And that's the sad thing. Shortly after Solomon inaugurated the temple, and after that grand opening of the temple and the inauguration of the worship, very shortly after, Solomon himself transgressed and the kingdom divided. The kingdom of Israel, which divided from the house of David, didn't have a good king to their name. Most of the kings of Judah likewise were unrighteous. And so at the expiry of 430 years, we arrive at BC 592, when the temple is destroyed and all the good work done by Solomon is undone. And we read of Jeremiah's lamenting what happened with the taking captive of the Jews and the removal of all the finely wrought ornamentation of that temple and all the furniture appertaining to it. And this begins 430 years of Israel eating defiled bread amongst the Gentiles, to use Ezekiel's words. 430 years of punishment essentially were to mirror their 430 years of disobedience. And during that period, they were taken captive into Babylon, and it began the process of overturning as God said to Ezekiel, I will overturn it until he come whose right it is, and I will give it him. One other point to note is that around the time of BC 334 to 331 were three battles of the Greeks in which the Persians were defeated. They were the battles of Granicus, Gaugamela, and the Battle of Issus. And if we take the 2,300 years we get from Daniel chapter 8, we arrive at 1967, which is a significant point to keep in mind. We'll come on to that shortly. And we must make some progress as we move through this. So what are God's promises concerning Israel? Well, we've got some general promises here. Firstly, that they would never be destroyed or utterly forsaken. So whatever they had to go through, whatever their plight, extermination, annihilation was not an option. It's not going to happen. God has said they will not be utterly forsaken. And we read that in Jeremiah 30 and verse 11, that he would not make a full end of thee. And there are other verses, we've got them there. Isaiah 43 talks about, though the floods were to encompass them, whatever the difficulties that they should face, they should not be utterly cast off. And of course we know from Romans chapter 11, Paul asks the question, hath God cast away his people whom he foreknew? God hath not cast away his people, is the answer. We also know that they would be disobedient. Ironically, we find from Deuteronomy 31 we read there that they would be disobedient. God says to Moses, thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, and this people will rise up and go a whoring after the gods of the nations, etc. And then he says that his anger would be kindled against them. So it was a prophecy that they should be disobedient. And yet the Jews have been the custodians of the scriptures, and they've preserved this witness against them. The Jews themselves have kept on record that which condemns them for their wickedness. Oops. We also read that they would suffer for their iniquity. In Jeremiah 30 verse 11 it said that he would correct them in measure and not leave them altogether unpunished. Also they would have miraculous victory over their enemies, that one should chase a thousand and should put to flight the army regardless of its magnitude. Also that their enemies should be recompensed. We read in Jeremiah 30 verse 16, therefore all they that devour thee shall be devoured. All thine adversaries, every one of them shall go into captivity, and they that spoil thee shall be a spoil, and all that prey upon thee will I give for a prey. Specific promises concerning Israel. They would be scattered among the nations. They would return to their land in the latter days in unbelief. They would initially reject their Messiah, but would accept him at the last. They would at the last become the head of all nations. And this will be where the reversal of their plight will take place. And rather than being scorned and derided, they'll be the head of all nations. And it will be the desire of someone to take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew and travel Zionwards with him. So, we're not going to dwell too much, as we said, on the Bible history. We're going to start our history really from AD 70. We read in Deuteronomy that God would bring upon them a nation as swift as the eagle, that they would be besieged and then scattered from one end of the earth even to the other. The eagle, we know, is the emblem of Rome. So this was written several years before Rome even was a nation, but yet this figure had been employed in Deuteronomy. Also we read of a yoke of iron, and iron is the metal which is most associated with Rome. And there's a link in Daniel chapter 2, which we can't dwell upon. But it's quite clear that iron appertains to Rome. Jesus gave a parable when he was on earth of tares. He said that there was a sower which sowed his seed. And then an enemy came by night and scattered tares. And the response of the sower was, "Let them grow together until the end of the harvest, and in the time of harvest I will say to the reapers, gather ye together first the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn." The year is AD 70. The year is AD 70, and the people of Israel have come together for their Passover. The time is around April, May. So the city of Jerusalem is swarming with people. People who've come possibly from other nations in their dispersal. They've come together and they're here in Jerusalem. Inside the city is pandemonium. The city is under control on the inside of rival gangs. These are zealots who are refusing to succumb to the Roman yoke. And they are slaughtering and persecuting and terrorizing those in the city who they feel might hand themselves over to the Romans. Not only that, even innocent people they're plundering and murdering. In some of their wars they ignite the stockpile of corn. So the food which they could have used for the siege actually gets ignited. And they lose some valuable commodities there. Outside the city walls are the Roman garrisons. After a failed attempt by Cestius Gallus 4 years ago, which had given the Jews false hope, but also an opportunity for the believing to flee to Pella, or to flee to the mountains, the Jordanian mountains, Titus and Vespasian renew their onslaught of the city. And we've got that very sad quotation up there from Josephus, where he describes how the Jews were nailed to the crosses in many different ways. So around the city were a series of crosses of writhing victims. We remember the words that the Jews themselves had cried previously, "Let him be crucified, crucify him, crucify him." They cried out the more exceedingly, "Let him be crucified. We have no king but Caesar." Caesar, Titus, not Caesar at the time, he was leading the armies. Caesar came along and gave them their deserts after they'd filled up the measure of their iniquity. Their rejection of Christ filled up the measure of iniquity of their fathers. A few years previously, Jesus himself had stood at the same position as this photograph was taken from, looking down on that city, and he had wept over it. "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them that are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thee as a chicken her brood under her wings, but he would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate." Your house is left unto you desolate. Indeed it was. And after the Bar Kokhba revolt, shortly after the sacking of Jerusalem, Hadrian ploughed Jerusalem with salt, banned the Jews from Jerusalem, and renamed it Aeolia Capitolina, erasing Jerusalem from the history books, essentially. I've got a lot to cover and I must really pick up the pace, but it's worth noting this from Titus, where Titus said, "We have certainly had God for our assistant in this war, for it was no other than God who ejected the Jews out of these fortifications." So even that heathen monarch recognized what he was up against, naturally speaking, but realized that somehow affairs were working in his favor. There's a man Dr. John Thomas in 1852, who was speaking at a time when Zionism was probably not a word that was known of in the sense that we know it of today. It was certainly before the first Zionist Congress in Baal in 1897. And this is what he said. And the reason why he could say this with such certainty and such confidence is that he understood the same scriptures which we have before us now, some of the verses of which we've already read. He said, "There must be a resettlement of the land by the Jew to a limited extent before the Battle of Armageddon, for it is the prosperity of the Jewish colony that whets the avarice of the autocrat. It will be a sure and certain sign of the speedy advent of the Son of Man in power and glory. No one need expect that appearing to be manifested until a Jewish colony be lifted up as an ensign upon an hill." So we move swiftly on to 1917, which is the Balfour Declaration. Before we speak of the Balfour Declaration, it really was a culmination of a series of events orchestrated without doubt by the hand of Providence. It began, we might say, with the Dreyfus affair. Dreyfus was an officer in the French army who, in an ignominious way, had his badges torn off him, and before all the people was decried as a Jew. Theodor Herzl was a modern Jew of the time, but with horror it struck him as he witnessed before him the strength of the anti-Semitic feeling, that the Jews needed a home, that they were unsafe anywhere outside of their home. And so the first Zionist Congress was convened in Switzerland, in Baal, in 1897. But when he proposed Uganda as a temporal homeland for the Jews, he was shouted down in the conference. It was a conference after the first one in Baal. He was shouted down and died soon after. And it was left to the whim of the British Empire to give support to the enterprise. And there we have the Balfour Declaration, where we read, signed by Arthur Balfour, I don't know if you can read it particularly well, it says, "His Majesty's Government view with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, etc." Rothschild, incidentally, belonged to the Jewish family, the famous rich Jewish family, not so famous perhaps these days, certainly they were at the time. The Rothschilds actually provided a loan to the British government to buy the Suez Canal from the French. The French dug the Suez Canal, arranged for it to be dug, and they decided to sell the shares. The British government asked for Rothschild to lend them some money, at which point they promptly bought the whole canal. So we can see that the operation of the Jews as a people, even in the affairs of the British government. And there were other important factors too. There was the Christianity which influenced these people who were involved, Arthur Balfour. I think the actual text of the declaration was by Lloyd George, who was a Welsh devout Christian. Herbert Samuel was also a prominent man in the government at the time, and he was by blood a Jew. The British government was also indebted to Chaim Weizmann, who was a Russian-born Jew, and had helped the government to produce acetone, which they needed for bombs in the First World War. So they were sort of indebted towards Chaim Weizmann, who was very, very high up in the whole Zionist movement. Shortly after, in December of that year, November was the Balfour Declaration, and December was the march into Jerusalem by General Allenby. Dismounted his horse, walked in on foot, and liberated Jerusalem from the Turks. It's not a very good picture, but you can possibly see, just in the dark alleyway there, as I think it is, the Turkish flag, which is a sign of another important prophecy concerning the drying up of the influence of the Turks in Revelation, which we can't go into, but the drying up of the Euphrates, was another type, following on from our speaker's address yesterday, another type which indicated the decline of the Ottoman power. So with the arrival of the British, the Balfour Declaration was able to be put into actual effect. We read from Elpis Israel, John Thomas said that the finger of God has indicated a course to be pursued by Britain which cannot be evaded, and which her counsellors will not only be willing but eager to adopt when the crisis comes upon them. When we see how the British turned their back on the Jews afterwards, we can see the truth of his description there, that regardless of the natural sentiments of the politicians, which is, it's altogether whimsical and capricious, God had mapped out a course for them which they would not be able to extricate themselves from, whatever their political stance. In 1948, it was a sad chapter for the British, really. It was the end of the Mandate period, and they left the Jews to their own devices. But not only that, in 1947, when it was voted upon that in the United Nations that the people of Israel should indeed have a state, the British actually prevented the import of armaments. So whilst the nations around them were already armed and equipped, this fledgling state had to come into existence as a nation, fight a war with all the Arab nations around them without even being able to import armaments. It really is only with the providence of God that they should survive. We have here some text which has been lifted from Scripture. And really the history, the modern history of the Jews, is the sort of thing we could put into the context of biblical text. And the intention here is not to bring down the language of Scripture to our own level, but rather to show that if a prophet was here, or a divinely inspired narrator was here today, he would be able to write in exactly the language that we read of when we read the book of Joshua or the Judges. We don't have too much time to read it, but hopefully you'll have been able to just glance up at that text there on the screen and recognize some of that language, at least, which is lifted from Joshua's chapter 9 and 11. A tiny little nation, a very small part of Earth's surface, yet one so prominent in the news, in history. Jerusalem is said to have had around 70 conquerors. In 1948, it was once again the scene of global attention. Now, if we look at the northern tip of the Dead Sea there, round about where my pointer is there, is where Jerusalem is. And Jerusalem was a crucial part of the war, as we can maybe briefly describe. This was the Mufti of Jerusalem who was heading up the Arabs at the time. Here we have the Burma Road, which was dug by the Jews in order to get supplies to Jerusalem, which was cut off by the Arabs, who were destroying any convoys which were trying to make it up the main road. And this was a road which the Jews dug in order to get supplies to Jerusalem, to their starving population. Now, David Ben-Gurion believed that Jerusalem was critical psychologically and strategically. And I believe he was irreligious. He certainly wasn't one who attended synagogues or anything like that. But he realized how crucial Jerusalem was to the people of Israel. And so he put as much effort as he could into liberating Jerusalem from the strangling effect of the Arabs who surrounded it, to the point that he actually sent Holocaust survivors who didn't even understand Hebrew or even know how to use the guns they'd been supplied with. He sent those people to free Latrun, which was the Arab stronghold near Jerusalem, in between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And of course, one of his fears was that if they were able to get through to Tel Aviv, Tel Aviv was one of the main centers of commerce there, and furthermore, if they could get to Tel Aviv, the nation would be split into two. Anyhow, they survived that war against all odds, and we can't go into too much detail. We move on to 1956, the Sinai campaign. And here we have another text gleaned from Joshua chapter 10. And what happened in the Sinai campaign was that following attack from the Fedayeen of Egypt, which was terrorism attacks in the southern borders of Israel, the Israelis decided that they would take the whole of the Sinai Peninsula, which at the time, of course, then was not in their control. This is the terrain which they had to deal with. It's all the more remarkable what they accomplished when we realise that to win this war, they were mobilising civilian vehicles like buses and ambulances. And you imagine taking a bus over that kind of terrain. Israel had 143 aircraft. Many of those aircraft were World War II technology. Some of them were piston prop. Not all of them worked. Egypt had 200 MiGs, which were jets. Modern technology they got from Russia. And Israel's ground force also was ill-equipped. Furthermore, because Moshe Dayan wanted this to be a complete surprise operation, it wasn't until 24 or 48 hours before that he mobilized the military. And yet, they managed to regain the Sinai. And unfortunately for them, through the politics of the UN, USA and Russia, they had to give that land back to Egypt anyway. So they fought the war in vain in some senses, but there were other positive results of the war, one of which I suppose was that the Arabs realized that they were dealing with a force to be reckoned with. We move on to the Six-Day War, which is in many ways one of the most remarkable because of how quickly Israel were able to gain superiority over their foes. Really speaking, the victory of the Six-Day War was effected in the first 3 hours of the operation, because the Israelis sent their aircraft to bomb the Egyptian runways whilst the Egyptians were on a coffee break. So they timed this perfectly so that the planes came in and wiped out the Egyptian force before they even had chance to get engaged in a dogfight. So they neutralized the power of the Egyptians before the war had even begun. They'd established air superiority within 3 hours of the war. On the right you can see is Abdel Nasser, and to the left is King Hussein of Jordan. King Hussein of Jordan was cajoled into a cooperation with Nasser. Nasser was a fierce anti-Semite and made quite clear that his plan was to make Israel consigned to the history books. He wanted to wipe them off the face of the map. The result of this war, you can see the territory occupied by Israel post-1948, that was the territory they occupied in a short period of 6 days in June of 1967. We've got some proof here of the signs of providence, which we'll have to, I guess, pass over. I'll just say briefly that some of those things we're saying, things about the Egyptians and the Syrians. Before the war, Amer, who was one of the leaders of of the Egyptian military had sacked his intelligence. So his intelligence was not there to tell him about what was going on. At the same time, up north in Syria, they were in the middle of a cull of their forces. And yet Nasser was still clamoring for war. So we can see the hand of God there in the intrigues of the military, ensuring that Israel were to be successful in this operation. That picture there was part of the newly occupied territory which Moshe Dayan walked upon. Moshe Dayan, being an archaeologist, felt like he may have recognized this. To the left, you can see the remains of a synagogue. You can maybe just pick it up on the hump of the hill. Josephus had talked extensively about this place. When this place had fallen, in around AD 70, the hand of God was working against them. Even the wind was not working in their favour, and some of the people had been blown in the gusts of wind over to the edge to their deaths when the Romans were there, and it was a slaughter. The Jews were wiped out. It was wiped clean of Jews. This time, in 1967, their victory was as thorough and complete as their earlier destruction. And we can see the difference when God is working for them compared to when he's working against them. And there's the Wailing Wall. Interesting story, just before moving on. The chief rabbi of Israel, Israel's military rabbi, Goren, thought it might have been a good idea, as they just liberated Jerusalem, to destroy the Dome of the Rock. He thought that might hasten the return of the Messiah. We think it would have been a good idea, but what he failed to understand was that the advent of Messiah was to be precipitated not by their success, but by their defeat. Yom Kippur War. You can see there that this time Israel were really onto a loser. You can see the comparison between troops and the inventory of arsenal and tanks and planes and so on and so forth. It's Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and this time it's the Jews' turn to be caught by surprise. This time, Moshe Dayan, always an optimist, is suddenly a pessimist. And he was quoted as saying to the tank commanders up north, "We must put our effort into this, otherwise this will be the destruction of the third temple." He was referring to the first temple built by Solomon, the second by Herod. This was going to be the third time he foresaw that the Jews would be expelled from their land. There was a time when, following the initial invasion, there were 15 tanks up north. Look at that, against 2,000 tanks of the Syrians, 300 supplemented from Jordan and Iraq. For the first time, Israel were actually losing. Golda Meir, the leader at the time, gave instructions to the air command to load up the nuclear bomb. They were ready that if they were going to be wiped out, they at least were going to die fighting, not like they had done in World War II. The most significant difference in this war was the extent to which Israel were being sponsored by a higher power. The Arabs were being sponsored by a higher power, and that is the Soviets. This was an address by an Israeli foreign emissary to Britain, and he said that the Russians give the Arabs so many arms, why should they make peace with Israel? And remonstrating in this way, he said that even in World War II, the Germans deployed 1,400 tanks on a 1,000-mile front. In a 50-mile front in Golan, the Syrians were supplied 1,200 tanks by Russia. That is interesting as a lead up to Armageddon, because the Bible speaks of Russia as being the prime antagonist who will lead an army down into Israel and will nearly wipe them out. Two-thirds of the Jews, we read, will be cut off. The leader of that force is Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, we read from Ezekiel 38. That's the direction which Gog comes into Egypt. From Egypt, he moves back towards Israel. At this point, we read that God will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity. Two parts therein shall be cut off and die. Jerusalem becomes a cup of trembling to all the people round about in the siege against Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. At this point, the Jews have to flee their own land and take refuge in Moab. Let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab, we read from Isaiah 16, verse 4. The ships of Tarshish, their only ally at the moment, are destroyed by an east wind. And here is the plight of the Jews at their darkest chapter. Shall I lift up mine eyes to the hills? When should my help come? The answer, as Israel will have to learn, and will indeed learn, is that their help comes from the Lord, which made heaven and earth. Behold, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. At this point, Christ and his saints move onto the scene, and that's sort of the direction taken, and the land is liberated from Russia. And here we have the moving scene at Jerusalem, described in the psalm. Lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be ye lift up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of Glory shall come in. Who is this King of Glory? The Lord strong and mighty. The Lord mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O ye gates, even lift them up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of Glory shall come in. Who is this King of Glory? We have to envision the scene here with the Jews in Jerusalem. They thought that extermination had finally come. They'd survived the attempts of Germany. They'd survived the attempts of the Arabs all around them. But now, with the Russians all around, they think that their end has come. And then suddenly, someone comes and frees them from the Russian yoke. Who is this King of Glory? The Lord of hosts, he is the King of Glory. In Zechariah, we won't turn to it, we read of the scene where they look upon him whom they pierced and mourn for him as one mourneth for his only begotten son. And they realize that for 2,000 years they have been in denial of their Messiah. And the Messiah who they've been waiting for is actually that Messiah who they rejected 2,000 years before. And a great mourning will follow. But with that realization and repentance will come a change in the fortunes of the people of Israel. Many of the promises in the prophets depict the joy and rejoicing which will follow that time when Israel's plight shall no longer be one of scorn and derision and persecution, when instead they shall become, as prophesied, the head of all nations and not the tail. Sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion, for lo, I come and I dwell in the midst of thee, saith the Lord. And the Lord shall inherit Judah, his portion in the holy land, and shall choose Jerusalem again. What does it mean to us? Israel's history, I'm sure we will all agree, is fascinating. It shows the work of God. But does it have any relation to us? The answer is absolutely yes, it does. As we read earlier, salvation is of the Jews. For the hope of Israel, Paul said he was bound with that chain. Abraham said, "In thee," God said to Abraham, "in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed." Paul said this, which is very interesting, in Romans chapter 11. He said, "If the fall of them be the riches of the world, and the diminishing of them," that's the Jews, "the riches of the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? For if the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead?" Dr. Thomas said that the pre-adventual colonization of the country by the Jews under the protectorate of Britain would be a very clear sign, which the practiced eye could see. He said that would be a sign which, if men were not stone blind, no one could fail to discern aright. The question for us is, are we stone blind? Are we ignoring this obvious sign of God's hand and the obvious sign of the imminence of the end of all things? Do we find ourselves perhaps engaged in the things of this life? If we do, let us look at Israel in their land. They seem like they've been there a while. We must remember that these recent events we've been looking at are in living memory for some of us. Some of us have been alive to see Israel declared a state and all that followed. Do we find, even though we acknowledge Israel is a wonderful sign, that the pilgrimage can be perhaps dreary and long? Do we exclaim, "How long?" Let us look at Israel as a reassurance that we are indeed in the latter days. Do we acknowledge that we are in a time of the end, that the return of Christ is soon to turn away ungodliness from Jacob, but find that the things of this life weigh us down? Look at the plight of Israel and their presence in the land to help us appreciate what in life is really important. Let us look at Israel as an exhortation to lift up our heads from looking at the trivial things of this life and upwards to the things which are eternal. To lift up our heads to know that our redemption draweth nigh.